I'm Andrew Stelzer, and this is Making Contact.
It's hard to get people to understand the forgiveness aspect was for me. And we could have never become friends, but I still needed to forgive you for shooting me.
Incarcerating our way out of crime clearly hasn't worked, and it's costing us billions. Meanwhile, school suspensions are reaching record highs. Now, institutions across the U.S. are finally starting to consider problem-solving methods other than punishment. Can victims and perpetrators sitting down face-to-face heal their wounds and our society?
Once we've got systems in place to really create nurturing, safe communities in our classroom, there's more time to spend on academics.
This week, restorative justice in the schools and behind bars. To open our show, reporter Joanne Marr takes us to a middle school in San Francisco that took a chance and moved away from zero tolerance discipline. The decision has transformed the school.
For years, schools in the San Francisco Bay Area mirrored the rest of the nation's schools. Disproportionate numbers of African American and Latino students suspended or expelled at high rates. But concern over these high numbers led the San Francisco and Oakland school boards to adopt new policies, promoting what's called restorative justice practices. It's a more holistic approach to discipline, based on a dispute resolution system that dates back thousands of years. The goal is to refrain from punishment, reduce the numbers of suspensions, and keep students in school.
I was a little skeptical, to tell you the truth, because I'd been using progressive discipline for 20 years, and I felt I was very competent at it. I thought I was very fair.
Paul Jacobson is the principal of Rosa Parks Elementary, one of the first schools in San Francisco to implement restorative practices.
Our suspensions went way down last year. We had, I think, 5 suspensions last year. This year we just concluded, I think we had 4 suspensions, and those were for some serious things. I think over time we will see even a further decline. It's my goal to get to zero, frankly, and I think it's achievable that we can get to zero.
The restorative approach is a collaborative process that allows everyone to be heard. The misbehaving student accepts responsibility and agrees to repair the harm. The first time Jacobson tried it, he was amazed at the results.
I took the student aside and I started, well, what happened? What were you thinking at the time? And I had the most wonderful conversation with this student about what had happened. And we got to what can you do to make things right. And the student had a real good grasp of things that he could do to make things right. I could definitely see a difference in how the student was responding to my intervention. That the student was internalizing what he had done, and that it had impact on more people than he was aware of. Children want to do the right thing. Children don't want to cause harm.
So get it going nice and loud, and then just take your right hand away.
Okay.
Restorative circles at Montara Middle School in Oakland often begin with the sound of a Tibetan singing bowl to help bring calm to the gathering. Today, the bowl sound is just for practice. Eighth grade student Michaela Porter is being trained as a restorative circle keeper.
Like, girls, they fight over boys, over clothes, money, like, stupid stuff. And it's really hard, like, trying to get through their head. It's not really what you should do at this time. And that's what I had to learn being in the situation that I got into.
Michaela was on the verge of getting pulled into a conflict with 5 other girls. What started out as a fight between 2 girls had rapidly escalated. At this point, Peer Restorative Justice Coordinator Yari Sandel stepped in.
I find out there's this conflict going on. There's these 6 girls, and 3 on one side, 3 on the other side, and they are upset about their friends who have been suspended, 2 girls who got into a very aggressive fight. Even one of the assistant principals had been hurt in the fight.
Me and 2 other girls were a little upset about it. And then we was going around looking for the girls and ready to fight until we came upon Miss Yari. And we all sat down and we had a discussion about it and how we shouldn't be fighting.
And so they wanted to pull together their peers, the 6 friends, the circle of 6. And they wanted to have that conversation with them to help them to get better, to heal the situation, the rift that had grown between them. So they came up with a circle. They came up with the questions. They figured out who was going to ask which questions.
Marilyn was one of the six girls who took part in the restorative circle.
Well, we all started off with like saying it was all going to stay between us and how to respect other people's opinion and like not talk while other people were talking. We would have like a talking piece that we passed around, and each one would get their turn to talk.
I really didn't want the drama to go on because it was too many people talking about it, and I didn't want my name all out there like that. So I kind of just was like, let's just squash it and let's get this over with.
She was asking how we felt about the situation and to tell our side of the story, just like basically to put each other in the other people's shoes. I mean, it took a couple of circles for us to understand one another.
I'm Bella, and I'm one of the girls that got into the fight. Like, we were putting a lot of effort in trying to work it out, but they were making faces, laughing while we were talking and letting our stories out.
To be honest, I feel like at first we felt like the circle wasn't gonna work, so we were kind of surprised when they decided to apologize and everything.
We were just like, it's okay, we're just gonna make sure this never happens again between any of us. And we're all gonna be cool after this, we're gonna hang out and stuff like that, say hi and bye to each other.
And then later on, the girls were like, okay, we wanna deal with the whole eighth grade girls conflict. Like, there's just drama going on. They wanted to have this big circle. I don't even remember how many girls were in that circle. Like, it seems like 30, maybe 40. Girls that were in the circle, and there were teachers who wanted to get involved at that point. So we had this, and it was just women talking with women about the situation between girls in middle school. So this one little thing started between two students, and as part of their plan, each piece kind of passed on and spread, and it grows into the going into the community building aspect, into understanding forgiveness, into relationship building and repairing harm.
For the purposes of our circle, we're going to need to push back so that we can squeeze some more chairs in, please.
Despite its promising potential, restorative justice has its share of critics. They question whether the restorative approach is too lenient and lets students get away with misbehaving. But Oakland Middle School student Michaela Porter says punishment just doesn't work.
When you get suspended, nothing really happens to you. You might have that type of parent that will yell at you, but nothing really gets through you because you're still mad still. And you might still want to fight that one person that you didn't like. It's really nothing that gets through your head. But when you come to restorative justice, it's a whole nother thing. Like, you get to sit down with that person and talk about your differences and like why you guys don't like each other and how you can solve that problem and how you can help each other get through it and how you guys can become friends again.
Restorative justice has the potential to revolutionize school discipline. Schools in Chicago, Philadelphia, Denver, and Minneapolis have adopted restorative justice policies, and the numbers continue to grow every year. For Making Contact, I'm Joanne Marr.
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. Because of generous support from listeners like you, this show is distributed for free to radio stations in the U.S., Canada, Australia, and South Africa. To find out how to donate, download shows, or get our podcasts, go to radioproject.org. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact.
You are listening to Making Contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. We're talking about restorative justice today, and we know it's a new concept for some of our listeners. So we have here in our studio Sonia Shah. She's Justice Program Director at the Insight Prison Project, also an associate professor at the California Institute of Integral Studies. And at the Insight Prison Project, she oversees the Victim Offender Education Group. That's a statewide and national program. And she's going to break down for us how restorative justice, also known as transformative justice, works, even in what might seem very extreme instances of crimes. Welcome to Making Contact, Sonia.
Thank you.
So first of all, let's just get the basics. What is the philosophy behind restorative or transformative justice?
Well, they're slightly different, actually, restorative justice and transformative justice. So maybe I can describe both. The best way of trying to really understand restorative justice is to actually look at our current criminal justice system. Our current criminal justice system is based on retribution, retributive justice, which is punishment-based, which is saying that if you commit a crime or you commit a harm, you should be punished. You should be sent to jail. Let's lock you up. Let's throw away the key. You should be suspended. You should be expelled. You should be punished. What restorative justice says is that when a harm happens, and I say a harm instead of a crime, that it's really a harm that's done to a victim and it's done to the people around it in the community. So the intention of restorative justice is to really bring a kind of reconciliation or a solution process back into the community, back into the hands of the people that were harmed, in order to really understand the impact of that harm and what can be done about it. So that's the basic philosophy of restorative justice. Transformative justice is based on this notion that there is systemic inequity, and that justice itself is flawed if we don't look at all of the ways that institutions and structures, racism, sexism, homophobia, the prison industrial complex actually create the conditions in which justice is impossible, which means that we really understand that people don't always start out on equal footing, that there's racism, that there's institutional oppression, and that that has to be taken into consideration when we're doing any kind of restorative justice practice. So a lot of victim-offender dialogues, these face-to-face dialogues between victims and offenders, are really about doing something that never happened in the courtroom. It's healing something that never happened in the courtroom.
Yeah, and we're going to get into some of those examples you just mentioned, and hear some clips, actually, recordings of victim-offender dialogues. I want to play, just starting off, a clip. It's a conversation between Nancy Potts, whose 9-year-old son Mason was killed by a drunk driver, and for the first time she's sitting down at a table with that driver, a young man named Chris Scheck. This takes place in prison, where Scheck is serving time for the accident. So we're going to listen to some of that conversation, and then we'll be back to get Sonia's reaction to explain what we've just heard.
So, Chris,
Nancy,
yeah.
We never got a chance to talk before. We've just
seen each other.
We've seen each other, and that was it.
We've met 3 years now. That's a long time.
Everybody kept asking me all along when I would say I was coming up here, well, what are you going to say? What are you going to say? And I'm like, I don't know. I have no idea what I'm going to say when I get here.
What
people telling you?
They asked me the same thing. The one guy thought I was crazy.
My family thinks I'm crazy. See, I don't remember. Somebody told us that you and your two friends were standing there when they took Mason out of the car.
No.
And I can't remember who told us, because they said, well, don't worry, he was standing there and he saw him pull the sheet. He saw them pull the sheet over Mason. And you, like you
if
said,
I've seen it,
you said that you didn't even know that he was in there until they told you.
No, the policeman asked me if I knew that I had killed somebody. And I said, no, what do you mean? He said there was a 9-year-old boy in the backseat. And when the guys hit, he died on the way to the hospital. I couldn't believe that I had done that. I couldn't even think. I sat up all night long smoking cigarettes and I couldn't, trying to piece together how it happened and why I missed the stop sign.
So, Sonia, what did we just hear there?
You heard an amazing clip between a mother, for the first time, who's talking to the man who killed her son. First thing is, in the beginning of the clip, both of them said, especially the victim said, my family thinks I'm crazy. And he responded, my family thinks I'm crazy for doing this dialogue. So victims already who are stepping way outside the criminal justice system, way outside a system that tells you, you better hate him. You better want the death penalty. You're doing something radically different. The second thing you heard, which is very common in dialogues, and a beautiful thing in dialogues, is that victims often want to know very specific answers. What happened? Where were you? You know, why? And what were the details? They want details because the image of a son being murdered, if you don't know and you weren't there, you want to know. So those are only questions that the person that has committed the crime can answer. And so oftentimes in dialogues, that's something that brings a lot of healing to the victim.
Now let's hear a little bit more of that conversation between Nancy Potts and the drunk driver who killed her 9-year-old son.
What happened, it makes me a bad person. I mean, I have a hard time forgiving myself what happened. I should have never been out that night. I know it now. I feel bad about it. I really do. And I wish there was something that I could do to change things, but there's really nothing. You know, I just keep trying to do something productive with myself now, you know.
Well, if somebody would have asked me 2 years ago if I was ever going to do this, I would have said no. I wouldn't have even thought about it. Because when they first told me the possibility of it, I was like, yeah, right, I'll never do that, you know, because I had it in my mind that I was never going to forgive, that it was just unthinkable to even be able to forgive, because I thought that would be betraying Mason. And then I was just so angry for so long, and it was just eating away at me. I mean, just the least little thing I would get angry about, you know, stupid little things. And I got so tired of living like that. I know that you didn't intentionally set out that day to kill somebody, or even to hurt anybody, or even to wreck your car. You know, it's just one of those things that you made a dumb choice to drive after you've been drinking, and unfortunately Mason was there in the wrong place at the wrong time. But, you know, it's like I come in here and I see that you're a human being just like me. You know, But now that this has happened, we just have to decide how we're going to deal with it and go on. Because we really don't have a choice. We just have to deal with it. And hopefully we'll make better decisions in the future because of it.
Yeah. I was going to write you a letter way back when I first came down here to apologize to you and to send my condolences. And I couldn't ever do it. So I'm glad I got to see you in person so I could apologize to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
We're back with Sonia Shaw from the Insight Prison Project. So we just heard what sounded to me like a mother forgiving someone for killing her son. She mentioned forgiveness. Is that the goal of these mediations, forgiveness?
That's such a great question. Forgiveness is not imperative. Forgiveness is not the goal. The goal is whatever the outcome that is necessary and decided by those two people. So, you know, what's really interesting is this mother describes her process, you know, of being, oh, if you told me I'd be doing this 2 years ago, I would never have done it. I was too angry. She describes her process of being angry. And what I would say is that the anger wasn't healing her. At some point, she said, this isn't helping me. So what do I do? How do I start to find ways to help myself heal, help myself have some peace around this? Not as though you can ever get full peace around it. And this is where these dialogues can be really, really powerful and profound. And so in her trajectory, she's going from anger to maybe some kind of acceptance / forgiveness. That's her trajectory. We don't judge victims. Some people will stay where they are and they'll be angry, and that's where they need to be. The other piece was he said something around, you know, what happens makes me a bad person. What I did makes me a bad person. And it's really what he was basically saying is it's really difficult for me to forgive myself. A lot of the men and women we work with in the surrogate panels, and this included, what happens when you actually sit across from a victim and they hear you and they're empathetic to you and you are feeling empathy back for them, is their willingness to have some acceptance or forgiveness can set offenders on a path towards self-forgiveness, which is huge.
Now we're about to hear a clip from the movie Unlikely Friends. It tells the story of victims of brutal crimes who, through forgiveness, unexpectedly become friends with those who hurt them. So in this first clip, we're going to hear victims and offenders come together in a restorative justice circle organized by the Insight Prison Project. So let's hear a clip from Unlikely Friends.
So my son Christopher Robin was murdered 15 years ago, March 21st, and he was 21 years old. He was at school, and he was killed by his school roommate. You feel like you've been run over by a semi-tractor trailer truck, but there's no bruises, there's no scars. You know, you just feel completely devastated, hurt, shocked. I lost everything a body can lose in the first 5 minutes, you know, because the shock was so intense. You know, and this incredible wall hits you that, you know, there's not gonna be any more pictures. There's not gonna be any more hugs. You know, you're not gonna be a grandmother. You're not gonna see a wedding. And you just, it's a lot. I mean, I've been practicing this for 15 years and it's still a lot.
For our listeners out there, we're watching a clip from a video here, and all those videos you can find at our website, radioproject.org, and we'll link to the Insight Prison Project's website as well. But just to give you a sense, there's a bunch of men in prison blues, for lack of a better term, sitting around in a circle with that woman telling her story. None of these men are the men who committed the harm that this mother is talking about. They're surrogates. So what is this surrogate process? You have a bunch of men sitting around who've committed other crimes or similar crimes to what she's describing. Is that how it works?
Yeah. So men and women sitting around in other prisons who have committed similar crimes. And so, you know, for a lot of victims that come in, they don't even know who's actually done the crime. So they can never actually have an opportunity to sit across from the offender. But by listening to men share, 10 men share, this is what I did. This is what I did. This is what happened right away. This is what happened 2 years later, 5 years later, 10 years later. It brings a kind of healing, you know, that it's like I'm getting a sense of an answer that I wanted. I'm getting a feeling that this is kind of what it's like for folks. And I wish that the guy that did this or the woman that did this would have this kind of insight. So, and a lot of these men that are sitting in their prison blues, they really get not only their role in listening and really kind of seeing, to really see the victim, to really see what she's going through and express their empathy and express the details of their crime back. It creates, I don't know how to explain it. It's some other kind of sense that, you know, that there's humanity.
So now we're going to hear a bit of the other perspective. We're going to hear from the offender in a separate restorative justice circle. He talks about his own life experience and how it related to the murder he committed.
And the most heartening day was when I came in the house. I was 18 years old. And I saw my dad with a knife against my mom's throat. And she had her hand trying to protect herself. And I was 18. And all I could do is get his attention on me away from my mom. And the anger was there. And I looked at him and I prayed to God and I said, God, let my dad focus on me. And that was the first time he ever heard me cuss. I said S-H-I-T. And that, it like it drew his focus. And then he told her to let go of the knife to come at me. And I used the little suitcase thing she had to hit him in the head, and it bust his head. And what I'm saying, all my life, I had to fight to protect my family, fight for my little brother, fight my whole life. And that what got me here, because when my friends called me 1 o'clock in the morning to go help them do stuff, I drove the car, supplied the gun. And I'm here serving a 29 to life sentence because I was detached. My action took the life of someone.
Sonia, your thoughts on what we just heard? Does the offender always address their own victimhood? Is that part of the process? I have to say, the cynic in me might say, well, this is shifting the blame and turning me into the victim. It might be like the story you tell a judge to get a more lenient sentence. So give some context for what we just heard.
Absolutely. Context is everything. I think what you're hearing is a clip in a much longer process. And none of these men would try to minimize or justify their crime with their own victimhood. If anything, it's the opposite. If anything, they know they'll never get out, and a parole board would never let them out if they minimize their crime and try to use their victimhood as a justification. So there's a difference between taking full accountability and really owning what you've done. And then when it's appropriate, at the appropriate time, when you're asked to try to, because actually victims want to know the why. And if they want to know the why, they want to know what happened to you, that you could do something like this. So there's an appropriate time to say, look, this is my life circumstance. This is what happened in my life that led to the crime. But there's a really big difference between kind of insight and understanding versus minimizing. What minimizing would sound like is, yeah, I did that. I totally did that crime. But, you know, this is different.
So, Sonia, how often does this type of restorative justice process work? And what are the ranges and outcomes? And how do you judge success?
The two most kind of crucial factors in the success of a restorative justice dialogue are the meeting with victims and the sense of making a plan afterwards. And I think, you know, I really want to leave by saying that this is not a process just for, like, you know, quote unquote offenders or people in prison. This is a process that anybody can use. I use it. You know, I do wrong all the time. I step on people's toes. I say something I didn't mean to say. And I usually need to sit back and reflect and be accountable to that. And if I'm lucky, there's somebody on the other end that's saying, ouch, you know, I really want to talk about this. And so I have used a restorative justice practice with my friends. We've passed talking pieces around and kind of talked about how we've hurt each other. You know, restorative justice to me is the most current and maybe most kind of popping nonviolent social movement. And it's something that can be applied, whether it's schools or communities or prisons or yourself, it can be applied across those multi-platforms.
Sonia Shah is the Justice Program Director at Insight Prison Project. We will link to their website on our website, radioproject.org. Sonia, thanks so much for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Please listen carefully.
That's it for this edition of Making Contact. Check out our website, radioproject.org, to get a podcast, download past shows, or make a difference by supporting our work. Like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm Andrew Stelzer. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.